just start with those of you who are here, and you know, let's hear from you. Let's start with, let's see, who's the oldest timer here? The oldest timer. Let's see, let's start, you aren't Mindy, but let's start with you.
Okay. I'm Mindy Grayling. I represent Roseville, Lauderdale, and St. Anthony Village, and I'm the lead Democrat on this committee, and I'll take this opportunity to say some of us have to leave for ways and means in the middle of it, hence I'm sitting down on the end, but I appreciate the offer to sit up, you know, with the...
From now on, Mindy will be sitting up at the front.
So, thank you.
My name is Ruth Johnson.
Would you speak into the mic, please, Ruth?
Happy to. Thank you. My name is Ruth Johnson. I live in St. Peter, and this is my third tour of duty in the legislature and my second opportunity to serve on K-12 or an education committee, and I'm very happy about that.
Welcome.
I'm Kent Deacon, and represent all of Norman County, all of Manoman County, most of Becker County, southern parts of Polk and Clearwater Counties up in northwest Minnesota. My second term, and second term on the House in the House Education Finance Committee.
Was that part of your district that was growing so fast, and what we saw this morning?
No, that wasn't.
That's just to the east of mine.
So
what was that actually? I don't
think
it was
Beltrami. Right, that'd be Representative Saylor's district. Most of it, I think. Okay. It looked like Beltrami County was the one that was growing.
That's what I thought too.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, the demographer mentioned Brainerd area and Aiken, and that didn't look right to me. But
the
I didn't have county names in front of me, so I wondered.
Yeah, I need to be up in the Bemidji area there.
Bemidji and Points
yeah.
North.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bud.
Yes, I am second time on education finance net policy, and it's good to see so many familiar faces back. And it's going to be fun. It's going to be I'm sitting on, I realize I'm trying to tell everybody there's no such thing as a DFL or a Republican side when it comes to education. We're all for education.
That's so, right.
Yeah.
That's right. Representative Bernardi.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I would have thought you would have been at that collaborative meeting we had. He's sounding so getting beyond the bickering at Humphrey Institute.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Where were you, bud?
I didn't qualify.
Anyway, I'm Connie Bernardi, and I represent the communities of Fridley, Blaine, Spring Lake Park, Moundsview. School districts, Columbia Heights a little bit, Fridley, Spring Lake Park, Moundsview, and Anoka-Hennepin. So it's from 2,400 students to the second largest school district in the state, and getting close to almost the largest. And this is my second year in education finance. I'm glad to be back. Thanks.
Randy.
What?
You're next to introduce
me. I knew that. Hi, I'm Randy Demmer, second term state representative from Dodge County and Western Northern Olmsted County. It's my second term also on K-12 finance. I'm glad to be back. Glad to see a lot of familiar faces. We can continue on. My district is very much like Representative Bernard. I have districts that are slowly declining in enrollment from a small size of about 900 students, K-12, up to, I have the Rochester School District, that is probably the third largest in the state, or fourth, or fifth, or whatever it is. No, I could be wrong on that, but it's a big school district. But I represent five rural school districts, and then part of the Rochester School District also. So it's a pleasure to be here.
Ms. Newman, do you wish to start from here?
How to jump from there over here?
Well,
you're not
we'll go back and do that.
I'm just teasing. My name is Scott Newman. I represent McLeod County and a little bit of Meeker County, which is west of here, straight west, about 70 miles. This is my second go-around on this committee, and this is where the real money is. That's what I like. So, I'm looking forward to serving again. Thank you.
We're the biggest spenders.
I was in judicial, what used to be judicial finance this morning. They don't know what money is down there. I mean, this is where the real money is.
We just wish we had more of it. Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm John Dorn. I represent basically the city of Mankato, a few precincts in lower north Mankato. So I only have one school district in my legislative district, District 77, for whom I taught from 1972 until the present. I filed my legislative leave before Christmas, and then after Christmas I filed my retirement papers. So I've got to call myself a former teacher when I can get used to that. I believe, Madam Chair, this perhaps is only my second time actually on this finance committee for the time I've been here. So I'm delighted to be here, and I want to assure Representative Durkin that those of us over here on this side of the aisle share your interest in a bipartisan approach.
Representative Erickson. I'm Sandra Erickson, representing Mille Lacs, Morrison, Benton, and Sherburne, which is one of the fastest growing areas of the state. I have increasing enrollment, stable enrollment, and declining enrollment. This is my fourth term on the Education Finance Committee, and I'm a retired high school English teacher.
And then let's just go ahead, and we are blessed with lots of wonderful staff on this committee. So we'll start with Lisa Larson. Please introduce yourself and just maybe say what you do and about how long you've been doing it.
Hi, I'm Lisa Larson. I work for House Research. I help with the drafting, but not with the finances, and I've been working for the House since 1983.
I'm Tim Strom. I'm also with House Research. This is my 19th year with the Ed Finance Committee and 22nd session with the legislature. I work with Mr. Crowe on education finance issues.
I'm Greg Crowe with the House Fiscal Analysis Department. This is my 12th session, and I just try and help Tim out, be his assistant, turn his pages when he's making presentations.
You can see between the three of them, we have an absolute wealth of knowledge. So anybody who needs to know anything about the history of anything we're doing here, I think between these three, they can help us with that. I'm Barb Sikora. I represent Western Suburban Area 33B, and I represent four different school districts, all of which are heading into declining enrollment. Go ahead.
I'm Bethany Johnson, the committee legislative assistant, and I'm also the legislative assistant for Representative Sikora.
And I'm Brett Walsh. I'm the committee administrator. I've worked at the House since 2000, and this is my second full session year with the committee.
All right. I think we just get a little business aside before we go on. I want to welcome all of you. We're delighted to have all of you here. It's nice to see familiar faces back again. We don't have any brand new people to education on this committee. I think the newest person we have is Scott, and you were on here last year. What, midterm you were elected? Or Tony Kilkuski?
December of 2013.
Okay. So you're here actually most of the time. If you look in your save file, you'll find the committee rules. And these are the same rules that we used before. I did make one change, and that's number 3. Instead of having a 3 o'clock deadline for amendments, we made it 5 o'clock because we have a little later committee hearing than they had 10:15 last year. We have 12:30, so I'm giving you an extra 2 hours. How about that? Otherwise, there's really nothing new on here. You notice we're trying to be really neat this year. You have little baggies for your post-its and your pens and pencils, just like when you go off to school. Yes, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to compliment the staff that put these together, because last session I forgot to put my cherished laminated sheets in my folder to take home and all my rules and everything, and they saved them and put them in my folder this time, and so I appreciate that so much.
We have a very efficient committee LLA here. Let's see, what else did I want to make sure you do? So that save file is the one place that if you want to keep things, put them there. For the next few days, you've got a lot of stuff in your file right now that relate to how we finance education, and that'll be in there till we finish going through all these reviews. And you might even want to hold on to them afterwards. But we won't have room to let everything just pile up forever in the files. Representative?
Yes, who is the stranger that just came in at the end of the table here?
Oh, Representative Dabney, you weren't introduced yet. I'm sorry.
No apologies needed. Thank you, sir. Jim Dabney, starting my third term from South Minneapolis. And good to see you, Sandra.
I also should introduce to you Karen Ballmer.
She is the Republican. What would you be? Research.
Research consultant.
Caucus research person. And Valerie, are you here? Oh, you're behind. I can't see over Bud. Valerie Dozland. And Valerie, there's plenty of room at the table in this committee if you would like to sit, you know, at the end of that table. Okay. Oh, yes. And our page. Jeff Schmidt. And Jeff is out of college, right, Jeff? And majored in education, as I understand it, and really wants to learn a lot about education. So he's using this semester to learn kind of what we do here. So let's give him a really good example of what we do here. Welcome to the committee, Beth. All right. Then a couple of other things I want you to think about. You probably know that the bonding bill is on a fast track. Any bonding bills that you want to have heard or that anybody you know of wants to have heard in this committee, we need them in here by the 24th. Or that they have to come in the 24th. We're going to hear them the 25th, 26th, 27th, that Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of that week. We will hear the bills, and then the following week we will send out our recommendations to the bonding committee, capital investment committee. Also, the other thing is reserve February 1st. I hope you all got the email. February 1st, we're going to go down and visit Waseca. I chose Waseca rather than Minneapolis just because Waseca started preparing for this last spring. And they are, you know, pretty far into now providing this program. And I think what's interesting about it is it has some of the elements that we've been concerned about for a long time. It has advancement for teachers within the profession. It has professional development for teachers. It has demonstrations, evaluations, et cetera, demonstrations of good teaching included in it, master teachers, mentor teachers. Some of the things that we've talked about over the years, and this is the Milken Foundation, and this is being essentially funded by a grant from the federal government, and then the Milken Foundation does the training and has a person now at the department paid by the Milken Foundation to work with school districts who want to try this. I think it's rather interesting, and I got kind of excited by it because there was a conference on the teacher advancement program late fall after the elections, and a lot of the Waseca people were out there, and their enthusiasm just really infected me. They are working hard, but they're absolutely loving it, and they think they're seeing some very positive, encouraging results. So something for us to look at and be considering as we go through the year. All right, I think it's time for the Greg and Tim show. So we'll ask them to go up to the desk. And in the meantime, are there any questions about, you know, anything at this point? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I glanced through that email. Do you have a rough, I don't remember what the rough estimate of the time commitment for that day.
Just well, we would hope that we could all leave here at 8 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can get out of here at 8, we'll be down there around 9:30-ish. And we want time to see the groups the master teacher works with. We want time to see what some of the classrooms are doing. They also have a charter school, and I thought as long as we're there, we would also take a look at the charter school, and we want some time to actually visit with some of the mentoring and mastering teachers and get a sense of how they feel about it and what they're seeing in the way of results. Just learn as much as we can while we're there. It's going to pretty much shoot your day. You're not going to be back in time for any other committees. But I think it's worth the time. We've been talking for a long time now about some other methods of pay other than the steps and lanes that we currently have, and ways of maybe drawing people, you know, who are excited about education into education. And I think this is something we can look at that might be an answer. It also includes, obviously, more pay for teachers who become mentors or master teachers, mm-hmm. as well as when there's increases in student achievement, there would be bonuses for all the staff. So, it's pretty comprehensive. Pardon? you know, at this point, Waseca is kind of putting together a schedule for what we might see and do while we're there. I don't know exactly how late we'd be there. Mm-hmm. I know we want to leave about 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And so if you can all manage to be over here early that day, most of you would be on policy. We're taking the policy time. So you'd normally be here by 8 anyway. So we're taking the policy time and our time, and then there's a few people with another committee in there somewhere. We wanted to do it early enough in the year where you wouldn't be dealing with a lot of bills and so on in your other committees that you would want to be there for. So this is the best we could do. So, all right. Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much. Mr. Crow and I's purpose in the next few days is to give you a brief refresher on the overall state budget and then spend a good deal of time on the particulars of the school finance formula. In your packets today are materials that we're going to use for each of the next 3 days, so if members could hang on to those, that'll save a lot of work on recopying the same materials. They're organized in ascending number order of the order that we're going to go through things. If you start with the sheet that says Overview of Minnesota School Finance on the cover of it, that's the section that we'll start with. As we're going through, we'd hope that you'd ask questions as you have them. We will be getting into some of the formulas in more detail, but please feel free to interrupt us as we're going. With that, Madam Chair, if you'll turn to the second page of the presentation, you'll complete the 9 areas that we're going to talk about over the next 3 days. We're going to start just by mentioning the guidebooks that both Greg and I prepare. Then we're going to look a little bit at the fiscal process for the House itself. Then the third section is where we're going to spend the majority of our time today talking about the context for school finance. After that, we'll go on and discuss the individual state aid and local levy programs. Then we'll talk specifically about the general education revenue program, and we intend to have a fairly detailed discussion of compensatory revenue, not today, but either tomorrow or Thursday. Then we'll talk a fair amount about special education revenue as well, and then the last two things that we hope to accomplish before Thursday is over is a discussion of how facilities are funded and how that's changed over time, and then a sort of broad discussion of equalization printouts, particularly as it relates to the referendum revenue program. So with that, Madam Chair, the next thing we'd like to point out for you is the two school finance guidebooks. It seems a little duplicative that we have two, but Greg and I each take a different approach when we do our guidebooks. I'll say just a word about the blue one, and then Greg will speak to the green one. The blue school finance guide is an attempt to give you a historical context for school finance over time. It tries to summarize 6 years of program history for each of the programs we've got. It's written in a style so that it's comprehensive about those programs, but it's not really designed as much as a workbook as Mr. Crow's is. There's a lot of overlap in the two documents, but part of the idea is that it gives you two different ways to think about each of these programs, and hopefully that'll help us increase the comprehension as we talk about school funding issues.
Madam Chair and members, as Tim said, the Green Book is not as comprehensive in terms of the number of programs it covers. What I try to do in this book is lay out each of the main funding formulas and give you a kind of a real-world example with a fake school district. In other words, I lay out what could happen in an individual school district in each of the programs given that characteristics of that school district. And also there's some additional information about what appropriations and levies that kind of on a current biennium basis. And so I think the books complement each other, and if you've got a question, you should be able to find the answer in one or both of them, and some additional information that could help you when you're thinking about any of the programs that we're talking about in this committee.
One other point, those are both accessible on the House website for those in the audience that would like copies. Hard copies are also available. The Green Book document can be picked up at Mr. Crow's office, which is 378 State Office Building, and the blue copy is available in House Research.
Madam Chair and members, Section 2 is kind of a general overview of the fiscal process, and most of you are familiar with this, but we thought it would be good just to mention it and talk about a couple of the unique things that are involved in this committee as we put a budget bill together. The legislature usually, or I shouldn't say usually, occasionally adopts budget planning requirements. The document that's attached in Section 2 is based on last, or 2 years ago, the document that was adopted. So this is kind of the draft for what the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy will take up when they talk, when they discuss budget planning. So if you look at the document on the fiscal analysis letterhead that says the Legislative Budget Process 2005 session, give you an idea of some things to think about as we're putting our budget together. The first paragraph just describes the process of budget forecasting, the December forecast, the governor's budget in January, the February forecast, then usually in March when the committees get their spending targets, and then the creation of omnibus finance bills. The second paragraph is important for this committee, where it says property tax levy implications for spending targets. The Education Finance Committee, in addition to an appropriations target that's set in the budget resolution in the Ways and Means Committee, will get a target for property tax levies. Generally, in the past, that target has been no increase over current property tax levies. We'll see later in one of the later sections that we track every levy that a school district can make, and when in doing that, we have a target for how much we can raise that or how much we need to lower those. There have been exceptions. Last year, for example, you all had a levies target of about $25 million increase. So as we tracked all those levies, we tracked an increase of about $25 million in total in school district levies. The reason this is important is that if there is a zero levy target, you may be approached to carry a bill, or you may hear a bill in this committee that has a local levy, a special local levy for an individual school district, and the folks from that school district may tell you that it doesn't have any state impact, therefore we don't need to worry about it, we can just include it and not carry the cost. We do track levies, so we do have to carry that cost in our, and it does count against your levy tracking target. If you have a zero levy target, what that means is if you've raised that levy, you have to go in and lower another levy to offset that one. And in the past, what we've had to do is take a program that's mixed, the revenue is mixed between aid and levy, fund an additional amount of aid onto that program, which in turn reduces the levy. So ultimately what happens is that the levy cost of that individual aid or individual pro levy turns into an aid cost against your spending target. So that's something unique to this committee that you need to keep in mind as we go through the budget budgeting process. And we do have in place a about a 50% shift recognition of property tax revenues. And basically what that means for you is that the rule of thumb is that any levy, and we exclude the debt service because those aren't shifted, but any levy that's increased actually generates savings on the aid side of about 50% of what the levy goes up. So last year, for example, when we had $25 million of new levies, there was about $10 million of aid savings. So the net cost, including those of doing a levy bill, is about half on the aid side. And that idea will get a little more clear as we start putting a bill together. Down on the bottom of the page, you see 05 session fiscal tracking. When we look at the appropriations, you'll see there's an 06-07 base amount. Excuse me. And the second page of that memo describes what we have to take into consideration for fiscal 2008 and 2009 as you make your decisions about 2006 and 2007. In 2008 and 2009, or though we're hearing referred to as tails or the out years, and basically we have to keep track of the long-term impact of programs that you implement or change or cut for the current biennium. And there's some rules for the base amount of tails. And unless
And when we generally assume that if there are ongoing programs, that there's going to be out-year costs unless we specify otherwise. There's some other general rules, but you'll kind of this all kind of become apparent as we go through the budget process.
Madam Chair, members, the next section we're going to talk about is in Part 3. We're going to talk about the general context for financing public schools in Minnesota. Mr. Crowe is going to speak about the state aids part of the budget. I'll speak about the local property tax part of the budget. Then we'll review some information on enrollment trends to get a little sense of where the students are currently at in Minnesota schools. And then we'll finish up this discussion with Mr. Crowe and I discussing how those school district funds are spent by broad category and how that spending has changed over time.
Can you hold it 1 second, please? We have a very important announcement to make, plus another member to introduce who kind of missed the introductions. Go ahead, Representative Klinzing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I'll be late. I'm Karen Klinzing, and I represent District 56B, which is primarily Woodbury and the community of Landfall.
And also, I forgot the cookies. I mean, are you wondering why I've got a whole bowl of cookies in front of me? Anyway, our wonderful committee administrator, Brett Walsh, his wife, baked these for us. I think she heard his job was in danger.
Brett,
why don't you just take these around while Tim is presenting? Go ahead. Please help yourself. Brett is afraid to take them home for fear he'll eat them.
Yeah. Madam Chair and members, we'll just start by giving you kind of a context in the state budget as a whole of where education spending fits. The state generates revenue through a variety of ways: individual income tax, sales tax, corporate income taxes, the statewide business property tax, and other smaller taxes. And then the expenditures come in K-12 education, healthcare and human services spending, higher education, local government aid, and other smaller programs. And the first couple charts and graphs, generally, there'll be a table of information and a graph for most of these first half a dozen items. So the first graph is where the money comes from. And just to give you an idea, for the 2006-2000 biennium, we're forecasting about $30 billion in revenue to the general fund, with almost half of that coming from individual income taxes and about a third coming from the sales tax. And again, on the back, you can see, if you're interested in the individual amounts, how much that is. And then you look at the next chart. General is fiscal 2006 base. So just for 1 year, the first chart was for the biennium. Again, about half from individual and corporate income taxes and about a third from the sales tax. Then the next chart is the allocation of general fund resources, in other words, where the money is spent. As you can see, K-12 education, which includes the early childhood programs, accounts for about 40% of the state's general fund budget. And the next largest piece is health and human services, then property taxation credits, then higher education. And again, that information is available in table form. You can see the K-12 education appropriations out of the general fund for 06 and 07 amounts to almost exactly $6 billion per year. When we talk about these forecast appropriations, I should mention, you may have heard of when the November forecast was released, $118 million was allocated to reducing the payment shifts from the 2003 legislative session. That money is included in these totals. So for fiscal, So that would be when we refer to 05, you'll see that or if you're wondering, that money is included in there. Again, the next chart is a graph of just fiscal 2006, the appropriations for that year. again, similar to the biennium, K-12 is 40%, higher at 10%, human services 28%.
Yeah. And part of why we want to bring it to a single year for you is we're going to combine it with a single property tax year. So even though all of your budgeting around here and almost all the committees really relies on a two-year biennial figure, and you think about them as a biennial basis. For school purposes, school folks budget on an individual year's basis, and you line up a year of property tax with a year of state revenue. So for school purposes, it helps us to put it in context to bring it to a single year. And so you'll often see us focusing on a single year at a time, particularly when we look at things like printouts or look at spreadsheets that match aid and levy together. And it...
Well, Madam Chair, members, as you make your decisions about the budget, one thing you'll see is that the impact is generally for appropriations will be shown for both years of the biennium, but because the property taxes for fiscal 2006, the first year of this current biennium, those property taxes are being paid during this calendar year and were certified last fall. As a result, as we go through looking at bills with a few minor exceptions, the changes you're going to be making will affect only the second year of the biennium when it comes to the property taxes. So basically right now the fiscal 06 levy amount is set, and you may see some adjustments to that levy, but the bulk of those levies won't change as you make your decisions. So that's why you'll only see the second year of the biennium on levies for the most part.
So as Mr. Crow mentioned, we've got about 40% of the state budget that's under your control in this committee. Ways that you can do things, you can allocate that money differently, you can grab a different share of the pie from that 40% to 42 or 43%, but if the pie doesn't change, that's going to mean one of those other program fundings has to change as well. In addition to the 40% of the state budget, the school districts also get about 25%, slightly under 25% of the total property tax. The next couple of charts are designed to give you some context to think about that. Because you're a big user of the property tax, it's important for you to understand the property tax system and to understand some of the dynamics about how that system works and where the controversy on the property tax system is in the tax committee as you make your decisions here. And this first table, called Taxable Market Value by Property Type, shows you the value of all the property in the state at its assessed value. And you can see there's $412 billion of homes and businesses and cabins and ag lands in the state of Minnesota. About 60% of that is the residential homestead. So the things you think about as houses where people live, 60% of that $412 billion is the homes. Two numbers I really want to highlight on this chart. Only about 15% of the commercial of the property tax as a definition of market value is commercial industrial, and about 12% is ag properties. When we go to the next table and we look at who pays the property tax in the state, the double-sided is throwing me off here. When you see who pays that property tax, you can see the residential homestead, which was 60% of market value, only pays 46% of the tax in the state. That's a deliberate policy decision that the state has made to keep residential homestead taxes low, relatively low, to other types of taxes. On the other hand, you can see commercial industrial property, which is in the lower part of the graph. They represented about 15% of the market value, but they pay fully 35% of the taxes paid in the state. Ag lands, on the other hand, which represent 12% of the market value, only pay about 6% of the total property taxes paid. And again, these are all conscious, deliberate decisions that the legislature has made in terms of tax policy. But what it means for you as members of the K-12 committee is that any changes in those relative shares, in those class rates that allow different properties to pay different amounts, are going to affect how your levies are distributed. So even if you choose to raise a levy by $100 per pupil, let's say, the way that levy falls on taxpayers is going to be impacted by what kind of tax base you spread that on and what kind of mechanisms are used to relieve that tax burden on certain types of property. And just to highlight one area where this is the case, for the operating referendum, which we'll talk about a little later, as you're probably all aware, that's spread against referendum market value. So that's spread against the tax base where all the property has a class rate of one, but two classes of property,
farmlands and seasonal rec are excluded from paying any of the operating referenda. On the other hand, most of the other school levies are spread on tax capacity, and the distribution of that levy looks very much like this chart here, where the commercial industrial property is paying about 35% of the freight and the residential homesteads about 46%. So important to keep in mind that how that tax base is determined by the tax committee is really going to affect how any levy changes you have are felt by school districts and by taxpayers within those school districts. The next chart then shows how that taxes are, how those taxes are collected by the various units of government. For taxes payable in 2005, and these are from the truth in taxation statements, they're not yet final numbers yet, by type of government, $5.71 billion is being raised by the property tax, and put that in context, the general fund on a single year basis from the income and sales and other kinds of tax was about $15 billion, about $5 billion by property tax, and you can see from this graph that the counties are the current biggest recipient of property taxes. Prior to the school tax reform in 2001, school districts by far and away were the largest user of the property tax, but after eliminating the general ed levy, they became the second biggest user, the county at 31% of the total, school districts at 24% of the total. Cities are about 22% of the total property taxes raised. Special taxing jurisdictions are about 4% of the total. TIF, the initial TIF, that's an acronym for tax increment financing, 5% of the taxable value in the state is in TIF districts and doesn't contribute to school district taxation. About 11% of the total property taxes paid are the statewide business and seasonal rec tax. That's paid by cabins and businesses directly into the state general fund. That's now about 11% of the total, and township tax is the smallest piece of taxing at about 3% of the total. So that's the... yes, Representative.
I just had a quick question about the school district portion. What percent of that is operating levy referendums, and what percent would be, you know, the levy authority that we have granted to districts over time for various programs?
Madam Chair, when we get to graph number five, section number five, you can see that breakdown.
Okay.
Of the $1.379 billion of school property tax.
Okay.
The voter-approved levies are 29% of the total. This is just on the cover sheet of the
okay.
fifth section that's in your packet. We skip ahead to see
oh.
this graph. So
okay.
if you don't need to do this, we'll just put it on the screen for you. On the fifth packet, the one labeled five school levies, $1.379 billion a levy. 29% of that is the voter-approved operating referendum. 44% is in the debt service fund, and almost all of that is voter-approved for building projects. There's a little bit in there that is not voter-approved, but the vast majority of that is voter-approved. So those two sections of the pie give you 70, almost two-thirds or three-quarters of the total school levy. There's about 40 levies in total spread out in a variety of very small programs, but those two are the vast majority of the total. And we'll get to that when we get to Section 5.
Representative Bernardi had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to refresh our memories regarding that statewide tax. Originally, it was 100% of that was supposed to go for funding education. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, originally it went into a reserve account, and the increase was
okay.
dedicated for education funding. But that reserve account was eliminated, I think, in the first year after the program was created, and it was just the increase that went into that reserve account.
Okay, Madam Chair, one more question, please. Representative Bernardi, I know you're quite a genius at this, but this might be a really challenging question for you, and it might be a little bit rhetorical, too, but is there any way of finding out on this operating referendum how much is excess levy for excess costs, and how much of it just being covered our basic education costs of our schools right now?
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, we don't have that kind of information available, in part because once the source of revenue goes into the school district's general fund, they can order it in whatever, it's all fungible, and they could order it in whichever order they want it. We will be spending some time when we get to Section 9 talking about the operating referendum and the differences among districts, but we don't have any data that would let us see that, for an example, in Fridley that 70% is used for basic purposes, and in Columbia Heights that 60% is. That kind of data is not available to us.
Representative Heidbergen.
Yes, I had a question previous when we talked about operation funding and we talked about referenda. You had mentioned that farm property and homes, cabins along the lake, et cetera, not homesteaded, are exempt. Are the two areas that are exempt, but is TIF district, if you establish a TIF district, are they also exempt from referendum?
Madam Chair, Representative Hiker, it depends on the age of the TIF district. There's some special rules that apply as to how the TIF district works, but essentially on the operating referendum, since that's on market value, generally speaking, it's going to be paying because the business property is mainly business property in TIF districts. If it, since that's on market value, not on tax capacity, that property is not excluded from the tax base. So the short answer is yes, that it pays the referendum. TIF pays an operating referendum. It won't pay for building bonds necessarily, but it will pay an operating referendum.
Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So, Madam Chair, then in summary, about 40% of the general fund and about 24% of all the property taxes are available and under the domain of this committee for spending on school programs. Next, we're going to give you a little bit of context about student enrollment. In large part, as you know, we fund on the per pupil basis or a modified definition of what a pupil is on that basis. And so it's important, I think, for you to have a little context for what this means. We'll show some charts here in a second, but a couple of points to make. School districts are very different in the state of Minnesota. We have a few very large school districts. We have many, many very small school districts. And we have quite a number now of very small charter schools. So often when we look at things like an average or a metro, non-metro average, it can be masking out all sorts of other things that happen because of the size of school districts. And we'll see that in the next couple of charts here. One other thing, when we talk about students for most purposes in this committee, we've got us on the next couple of pages, we define how we count pupils, but we'll generally be displaying information to you on an average daily membership basis. That's on a per kid in the classroom basis. But for most of our funding formulas, they're computed on a slightly different basis, and we'll spend just a minute reviewing those now. When we go to count students, the place that we start are essentially on the definition of average daily membership, or ADM. And that's essentially the full-time students that are counted in each district that are public school students. Pardon me. In a district like Wayzata, for example, to get that initial number, the adjusted daily membership, what we'll do is count all of the students in that school district who have gone to or who are going to public school, regardless of where they're going to that school at. And the first adjustment that we'll make is we'll make an adjustment called adjusted pupils. And what that does is say, well, let's focus on the kids that are served by the school district. So we don't essentially, most of our school finance formulas don't key off resident kids. They key off kids served by that school district. So if 50 kids leave the Wayzata school district to go to the Orono school district and 100 kids come into the Wayzata district from the Robbinsdale district, we make those modifications to get our adjusted pupil count, our adjusted ADM. And that's really the measure we use for most comparison purposes. But for funding purposes, we do two other things to the pupil count. The first of those is we weight pupils by grade level. And there's a chart on the next page that shows what those grade level weightings are. We weight kindergarten students at 0.557, which is roughly half time, slightly more than half time. For any student that's either disabled in kindergarten or pre-kindergarten disabled, they're weighted according to the hours of service that they're provided. For the elementary school children in grades 1 to 3, they're weighted at 1.115. For those in the upper elementary grades, they're weighted at 1.06, and the secondary students are weighted at 1.30. So when we get our definition of adjusted marginal cost pupil unit, which is our funding pupil unit, it has these pupil weights thrown onto it, and there are some history behind why these weights are where they are. I think one of the most important things to point out to members of this committee is regardless of why those weights are there, anything that changes those weights will change the distribution of revenue throughout the state, and some school districts are winners and some are losers if we do change those weightings. So even though I think nearly everyone agrees our current weighting system is kind of wacky, the end result of changing it is you're going to get winners and losers. The final thing that we do then with with our weighted count of pupils is then we put on a slight adjustment called marginal cost, which essentially reflects declining enrollment. And what that does, and again, the percentages here are legislative compromise between the House and Senate, so they're at a funny number, but essentially we count 77% of the current year pupils and 23% of the previous year's pupils when we get our total pupil count. And what that does for a district in decline is basically allows the district to count leaving students. For every four that leave, they get to count one for the next year. It's not a very artful way of doing it, but the effect is it does help for those districts facing declining enrollment. And next, I'd like to show you a few charts of what's happened with enrollment over time. The first of these on the top line shows the public school enrollment from 1960 forward. And what's really important to point out here is that from 60 to 72 is sort of the height of the baby boom going through the school system. And you can see that we had a pretty radical increase in funding over those time periods. From 1972 to 1984, we had a decline in enrollment, and that was a pretty sharp decline in enrollment. And those were really solid days for the legislature because funding on a per pupil basis with fewer pupils each year meant you could pay the same amount per pupil and have money left over. So you could either increase the amount of funding in K-12 per pupil or you could move the funding to other areas of the budget. Starting in the mid-80s, this changed relatively unexpected at the time and often referred to as the baby boomlet coupled with migration changes in the state of Minnesota meant that we had some pretty substantial enrollment increases. Our enrollment went from just under 700,000 in 1985 all the way up to about 850,000 in 2001. That appears to be our peak year of enrollment on the adjusted ADM basis, but you can see now for the next 15 years out to 2017, we're expecting relatively very small changes in enrollment. So what this means is during the 80s and the early 90s, the legislature had to contend with growing enrollment to provide the same level of funding, took more money each year. Really starting with part of last biennium and now with the biennium you're facing, with slightly declining enrollment, you'll need to spend a little less each year in order to provide the same level of funding. A couple other lines on that chart. The non-public line is shown in the dots toward the bottom. You can see that peaked about 6 or 7 years prior to the public school enrollment and fell pretty dramatically and had a decline up into the mid-early 90s and now has increased a little bit. We have some reporting issues with non-public schools, so there may be slightly more than are shown here, but basically we expect we're at a number in the low 90,000s of the number of Minnesota students who attend non-public schools. Two other lines on the bottom. The heavy line is the number of homeschool students, which now is about 15,000. There were plenty of homeschool students prior to 1987, but the state didn't collect any data on that, so our data series just starts there. And then charter schools began operations in 1992, and that's now grown to about, we think, about 17,000 students in charter schools this fall. We'll have better enrollment information in a couple of weeks. That's been a fast-growing area from year to year, but on the other hand, in terms of total number of students, we're talking about a number under 20,000. So that gives you some sense of statewide what's happening, but I think what you'll see now is when we look at your school districts, for almost all of you, your districts are very atypical because our state is not a very good one for averages. And the first of these charts shows enrollment by region. We have 48 school districts in the metropolitan area, in the 7-county metropolitan area. They comprise more than half of the children in the state now, and the school children in the state, at 53% of the total. 4 years ago, they were less than half still, and as far as Minnesota was a state, the majority of the students had been out in greater Minnesota until 2002, and in that year, the metro area started having a greater student count. But what that tells you, I think, is the demographics of greater Minnesota are changing much different than the 7-county metro area. As you look at the regions of the state, if you take the economic development regions of the state, you can see the relative proportion of students in each of those regions. The other regions still don't add to the metropolitan area, and this is just the 7-county metropolitan area we're using as a definition here. On the next chart, you can see the percent of students enrolled by school size. And the purpose of this chart is not only do we have a distinction between the metro area and greater Minnesota, we also have a large distinction based on the size of the school district. The 69, and the label, the legend's a little goofy here. I made a mistake on the legend. The 69 smallest school districts are the first listed on the left there. You can see that they comprise less than 3% of the total students in the state. The next 69 school districts comprise about 5% of the total. So between those two groups, we're at about 7% of the total. The mid-fifth, the mid-quintile of school districts in the state gets us up to about 8% in total, so the two are not even quite 16% of the total. And then the fourth highest group of school districts, the fourth quintile, the 68th, second to largest group of school districts, is about 13% of the total. So fully 70% of the students in the state are in just 68 of our 343 school districts. So again, this enrollment distribution, very different for your school districts from each other. The big districts overwhelmingly have the largest share of population, but many, many small school districts, and because of that, our school finance formulas reflect some of those differences.
Representative Heidkirchen has a question.
Yes, in regards to the definition of a district.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, charter schools are not a district.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidkirchen, for purposes of this distribution here, they're not considered a district. Uh-huh.
Magnet schools are districts?
Madam Chair, magnet schools are going to be part of a school district of one sort or another. We have, to my knowledge, we have just one magnet school that's not run by a school district, that's run by an intermediate school district, but otherwise they would be a part of a school district.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know what the number is for the school districts when it starts the 68 largest districts? Do you know where the enrollment is?
Madam Chair, actually, we've got this data separately. We can print it out in that order for you. On the spreadsheet we had loaded up to double-check Representative Demmer's work on how big Rochester was, we could count down real quick and see where the 68th is. I'll go do that in a second here and let you know where that is. But all of that kind of data, if you're interested, we can sort these things and print them out for you or pop them up on the screen for you here. You're going to see that the largest of the large are quite heavily dominate. Basically, we have about 10 very large school districts in the state. The next 50, some of them, are relatively medium-sized compared to those large ones, but very large compared to the average school district in the state. Madam Chair, the next chart we'd like to show you shows what's happened to school district enrollment over time. Now, remember back to that first line graph that showed you that enrollment was relatively stable from about 2000 out into the future. But what that masked, and you can see that here, is what that masked is changes in nearly all but two, in all but two regions of the state that were negative. So as you look at this chart, you can see from 97 to 2005, in a 9-year period, the Northwest area school districts declined by about 14%. The Northeast portion of the state, the Arrowhead region, their enrollment declined by more than 18%. And all the way across until you get to the East Central region of the state, which sort of is a band of districts in the Cambridge area, if you wrapped a line around the northern part of the Twin Cities, that forms the East Central area of the state. You can see that's the only area that's had substantial growth over that time period. And the Seven Country metro area has had a small growth over the time period. But for those 9 years, almost all the school districts in the state, well over two-thirds of them, are in decline on pupil units from 1997 to 2005.
Representative Packard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A better definition of East Central, St. Cloud?
I'll double check on that. I think the band stretches from St. Cloud across to the border. I'll double check on that. But if you look on the next two pages here, you can see the school districts listed by region. And if your eyes are any good, mine aren't, we'll see if St. Cloud 742 shows up in region number 7 there. Yeah, it does. So that, and Elk River and Santee and those districts across the top there are in that region 7. But you can see which school districts are in each of the region, and the district within the region is followed by the district number, district name, and then the ADM for fiscal year 2005. So you can get a sense of where those growing school districts are, and those are the Beckers, the Big Lakes, Elk Rivers, North Branch, those kinds of districts that comprise the east central region of the state.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, as far as the Seven County metro area, I thought there would be greater growth there considering the growth in population. Can you explain why there's not greater growth?
Madam Chair, Representative Eakin, starting around 2000, many of the metro area school districts peaked at their enrollment. Many of the second and third rings of their, particularly I think Representative Sikora's districts, for example, are now starting a slight amount of decline. Mm-hmm. One other factor that's not in this graph, and again, it's relatively small numbers compared to the total, but is meaningful in some districts, is this reflects the school district enrollment and not the charter school enrollment. So in a district like Minneapolis, part of their large decline over the last couple of years is children choosing a charter school instead of the school district. But nearly all of the sort of core suburban districts and Minneapolis and St. Paul are, if they're not leveling off, are going to do so in the next couple of years, barring any changes in migration patterns. So declining enrollment, I think don't quote me on this number, I think it was 280 of the districts had declined from 97 to 2005. And I suspect by in another year or two, it'll probably be over 300. We'll probably have about 25 school districts in the state with any growth at all.
Representative Pyatt-Gergen.
Yes, a follow-up question. I know I'm just looking at East Central, and I know for a fact that there's some school districts, obviously, in that region that are declining as well.
Yeah.
The other thing is, now this is just public school. This is not homeschoolers, and this is not private school students.
Madam Chair, Representative Pyatt-Gergen, that's right. But there aren't further questions on the enrollment. We're going to move on now, and Mr. Coe is going to talk a little about some of the next couple of graphs to give you a little more context for how the health, training, and secondary funding fits into the state budget. And I'll double-check on Representative Bernardi's question.
Madam Chair and members, the next chart after the pages says state aid for schools, which is kind of describing this chart, shows basically the mix of or the amount of the total funding aid and levy, total revenue for school districts that was paid by the state. As you can see, between fiscal year 1996 and fiscal year 2002, it stayed relatively stable in the 65-70% range. And then in fiscal 2003, when the legislature appropriated around $1 billion to pay off the general education levy, that percentage jumped way up to 92%. After that, at the same time that happened, the state also moved the first $415 of every school district's referendum to the general education formula. And what that did was shifted that money from levy for the districts that had high property values to all state aid. But it also created an environment where districts were willing to go out and attempt to get additional operating referendums passed. You see that happening in fiscal 2004. Part of the reason why there's the drop from 92 to 83% because of the significant numbers of additional operating referendums that passed at that point. We'll talk a little bit more about operating referendums in a bit. But since then, that number stays relatively flat. And at about in the low 80s. And it's declining a bit as property values increase and more of the programs that are mix of aid and levy move to levy rather than aid to pay for those programs in an era of relatively flat state funding. The second, or the next bar graph, kind of a historical look at education funding as a percent of the general fund. Now again, for this biennium, we're at about $15 billion per year in total general funds. Obviously that was smaller in fiscal 1983 when the graph started, but as a percentage of the general fund budget, the overall trend has been to
to increase the amount of education spending as a percent of the general fund. And you see partly because of declining enrollment and partly because of the significant increases in health care costs that are projected to occur over the next 2 years, you see that percentage of the general fund budget falling for fiscal 2006 and 2007, the projected amount of spending. And then the pie chart that says elementary secondary education revenue sources, basically that explains one of the bars, the fiscal, what this is for fiscal 2006, one of the bars on the first page where we show the 80.2% state share. The state share it uses the appropriation numbers. In addition, there's a small amount of tax credits, and then you can see the 18.2% for this year, 2006, that's projected to be funded through levies. And then finally, there's a very, very small sliver of dedicated funds, which includes the permanent school fund, for example. And if you go to the table with the really small print, that's the data behind the two graphs that talk about the state share of education funding. If you look kind of about two-thirds of the way down the page, you see a line that says percent change. This just gives you some detail if you're interested in the actual numbers, how the $7.6 billion in 2005, for example, how that is distributed between the various ways of funding that, and that shows you the state share, shows you there's an ADM line, a revenue per ADM, and there's some other calculations per student at the bottom of that table that you might find interesting for informational purposes, if you can read them. Then the next chart shows you where that money, how that money is expended. So for fiscal year 2006, we're projecting total revenue of about $7.4 billion, and that's based on November forecast. And the vast majority of that, 68%, is going to go into the general education program, and we're going to talk pretty extensively about that either later today or tomorrow about what makes up the general education program. But generally, that's the largest part of the school district's general fund, or kind of undesignated revenue that can be spent however the district wants.
Mr. Crowe, we have another question from Representative Heidgergen.
Yes, I hate to back you up. I'm going back to the graph on education spending as a percent of general fund spending. I'm having a hard time. I'm looking at the numbers for 04, 05, looking at 42% and 42.9%. I would think with some of the referendums in place that the percentage reliant upon property tax has gone up, that the general fund would show a decrease there.
Mr. Crowe.
Well, Madam Chair, and Representative Heidgergen, remember this is just the state aid that we pay. The state aid that you appropriate out of the general fund as a percentage of the entire general fund. So as there are additional operating referendums that are equalized with state aid, there'll be more state aid going out, and that actually will play into a higher number on this chart.
Okay.
Representative Bernardi. Thank you, Madam Chair. Since you allowed him to go, Representative Heidegger, and go backwards, I'm going to go back one more page. I really want to understand this number, this 92% down to the 83.2%, so we all have common understanding about that. We promise to take, would it be accurate to say we promise to take over 92% of education funding and pay for it at the state level? And then the next year, we didn't have the resources to keep it at that level because the surplus didn't exist that we thought, and so now it went down to 83%. I'd like to have a clear understanding of this.
Madam Chair and Representative Bernardi, the legislature committed to eliminating the general education levy,
mm-hmm.
and they did that. There was not any commitment to a certain percentage of state funding made in law or I think even in the discussions. It was to get rid of that levy. In fact, I don't think we even calculated this percentage until after this legislative session that bought off that levy completed because of the other interplay with the tax committee and some of all the things that were happening during that session.
Please, Madam Chair, can I follow up with a question so I understand this? Thank you,
Bernardi.
Thank you. I would have assumed that the next year that we would be paying, the state would be paying 92% of education funding, and it's not. Can you help me out with the reason? I know you had mentioned that.
Madam Chair and Representative Bernardi, there's a couple of big things that are coming into play there. And you kind of, one shows up in the detail on this table with the really small print. And that's one of the big tax shifts occurred in 2003. I'm going to zoom in here. Right here. Tax shift adjustments. If you look at note C, fiscal 2003 includes $1.4 billion of additional aid, and that was from the buyout of the general ed levy. That's the note down on the bottom.
Okay, wait. I got to figure this out. The C columns, Madam Chair?
Yeah, we're at okay. This 2003 at the top. Mm-hmm. You see tax shift adjustments, negative $442,350. Down about mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 groups.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a significant amount of aid moved out. So the net is there, if you look down on note C, there's $1.4 billion of conversion of levy to aid and a shift of $442 million from conversion of 90-10 to 83-17. So basically $1 billion in aid was added. And if you look at the levy line, which is two groups up, you see the levy going down from 2.4 to 1.0 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the big swing in 03 is the net of those of the shift and the $1.4 billion payoff and the $1.4 billion reduction in levy. Well, what happened the next year? Why did it go down? Well, if you look at education tax levies, they go up by 20% in fiscal 03-04. And that's the 2, 3, 4th group down. Goes from $1,068,000,000 to $1,275,000,000. So there's a 20% increase in tax levy. And the net increase, if you include, the net is the next line. The net increase is about 25%. Because of that, and a big part of that levy increase is the new operating referendums that I mentioned, the 415 buy-off created an environment where a lot of new operating referendums mm-hmm. were passed. If we kind of step back and if that was the only thing that happened, that skewed funding more toward levies because the equalized amount on those levies was smaller than 50%. If it was 50-50, actually it would have to be 90% aid to keep that 90% at 90%, and the equalization amount wasn't high enough, wasn't that high. Mm-hmm. And so the passage of those levies, in addition to the normal kind of annual increase in levies because of growing tax value, we saw back on when we're talking about the mix of what levies were on that five, that 44% of our levies are debt, those are based on tax capacity. Tax capacity is growing, so there's a lot more of the debt getting paid by levy than aid. So in addition to our normal annual shift to levy and some of those types of programs, we had a large increase in the number of operating referendums which passed, which added to the levy and didn't add nearly as much to the aid, which was a big factor in moving that 90% down to 80%. Because, in other words, if you look on total revenue, between 03 and 04, there's $800 million in additional revenue. A greater proportion of that was levy than was aid. And we have funny things happening in there because of the shifts, the change in shift amounts. Okay. There's $442 million shift and then $414 million shift. So, and that's all aid. So that affects it as well.
So the fact that we went from 90-10 to 80-20 has an effect on this percent also.
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. that's got to be, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Jemmer. Oh, he's passing. Go ahead. Any other questions while we're
okay.
stopped here?
Madam Chair and members, I think, yeah, we were discussing education revenues by category, talking about that the biggest piece is the general education revenue. You can see referendum about 7%, special programs, the biggest of which is regular special education and special education excess cost funding. Facilities and technology, the bulk of which is the debt service, the health and safety, and the alternative facilities programs kind of make up the biggest pieces of it. And you can, if you're interested in the actual dollar numbers, that's the table that's on the back. Describes kind of each component that's in that pie chart and how much is aid and how much is levy.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney, I couldn't find your voice.
Quite all right, thank you. Mr. Crow, I'm thinking back to when you first presented this chart and you described the general education as the money that districts can spend kind of as they wish. And I was wondering at that point if special programs included compensatory aid and ELL or whatever set of acronyms we're using, letters we're using for that aid at this time.
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, no. General Ed would include compensatory and LEP revenue, which both do have some. There are some restrictions in the general education program about how money can be expended, but of the undesignated revenue that districts receive, the largest part comes from the general education program, and the majority of the general education program is undesignated. But you're correct that there are specific there are some categories of revenue that have spending requirements with them.
Quick follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. Mr. Crow, my recollection, if you could refresh my fading memory, is that compensatory aid goes to the site. And I believe there's a small percentage that districts can hold back for administrative purposes.
Yeah.
Is that the same with ELL?
Madam Chair,
or whatever.
Representative Dabney, you're correct on there's a 5% district holdback or administrative amount, whatever. And then there are, and there's not a similar provision for LEP revenue. And we will get to kind of what the components of general ed are, and that's the chart that's kind of up overhead right now. But you can see that only about 5% of basic funding or of general education revenue, if you include revenue, is compensatory, and only about less than 1%, 0.7% is LEP. So about 95% of the revenue is kind of in that undesignated category. Operating capital has some limits on it as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, well, to finish up this group of charts for you, we'd like to offer up a couple of charts to explain the seeming disconnect that this committee sometimes feels with.
Mr. Strom, sorry. Representative Heidger.
Before we go on, when looking at the total picture there now, the federal monies are also in there, and we're talking about total revenue.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidkirk, and no, this is just state aid and local levies. It doesn't include federal. And the other component that is significant for school districts is fees.
Okay.
Fees and other special, and the biggest part of that is bringing accounting for lunches, and, you know, payments for the lunch. And
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Crow, one more quick question on the breakout of the revenues by category. I'm interested in looking at the percentage of revenues schools are getting as a result of referendum. Okay, and 7%.
Mm-hmm.
I just was looking at the chart here, and the total of the referendum dollars on the bottom, the 515,770, is a sum of the levy and the aid together. So in actuality, there's some aid in that 515,770, so that 7% is actually a little high. Isn't that right?
Madam Chair and Representative Demmer, the chart on this chart is revenue, and we use that term. That's actually a specific term. They aren't interchangeable. Revenue means aid and levy.
Okay.
So we talk about aid or appropriation. That's just state aid, levy, property tax, whatever. That revenue means both, and so this is revenue. So of the district's $7.4 billion. $515 million or 7%, this number on the on the back is referendum revenue. So you could say that about 1.5% of their revenue is referendum aid, and about 5.5% is referendum levy.
Okay, that's the point I wanted to make.
That's how you could divide that pie piece into aid and levy, and you could do that with all of the pie pieces.
Okay, thank you. That's what I was after. Because at first when I looked at this, I thought, oh, 7% of our school's money is coming from referendum from taxpayers. But when you look at it more closely, it's actually about, like you said, 5.5%.
Right.
That actually comes from local taxpayers and the levy. The rest is coming from state aid, even though 7% is generated by referendum.
And this chart is the same chart as when we were looking at by source, where you can divide that same chart into 80% state aid, 18% levy, 1% tax credits, 0.5% other. It's just divided by component rather than by source.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, just for your rough sense of size, federal funds are about, when we talk about total revenue of money from absolutely everywhere, federal funds are between 5 and 6% on average of a school district's total budget. The fee income is about a little over 10% for most school districts. So that gives you some portion of the money that we don't talk about in here, largely because those aren't federal funds this committee has very little control over, and the fee revenue tends to be for, as Mr. Crow mentioned, programs like lunch, where, again, the legislature's role is somewhat limited. Madam Chair, the next three graphs then are designed to give you a little sense of the disconnect that this committee sometimes feels when talking to other committee members from other committees in the legislature, when talking to school board members, and when talking to parents about education funding. And what the next three charts do are they all convey what's happened to school district revenue over time. And the first one shows on the top line, the solid line, unadjusted for inflation, school district revenue from 1984 to 2005. And you can see on this chart, on a per pupil basis, in 1984, school districts spent about $3,900, slightly over $3,900 per pupil per ADM. And by 2005, on average, the average school district in Minnesota, all sources of revenue, and this includes federal funds and fees, is over $10,000 per student. So the message that many people around this building, particularly not on the education committee, feel is, boy, school funding's really gone through the roof. We've gone from $4,000 a kid to over $10,000 per kid. The next line adjusts that for inflation using a CPI deflator. You can see there's still significant growth from slightly under $4,000 to slightly under $6,000 per pupil in what we call real funding. So I think many members not familiar with what's going on in the schools look at that chart and they say, well, school districts have really turned out pretty darn good. What's all the noise about? And the next two charts try to put some context for why the noise is as loud as it is. And what the first of these does is it looks at the same revenue amount, the same top line there. And this chart, unfortunately, since it has some expenses and it only goes through the year 2003, so there's two fewer years on the chart. But you can see there that top line is the same as the previous top line. Revenue grew from $3,900
to more than 10,000. But then this chart factors out two areas of funding that really aren't connected to the regular instructional category of funding. And the first of those is taking out building debt for pupil, and that's what the dotted line does. There's been a tremendous, and when we get to the facilities section, which is part 8 of our presentation, we'll talk about this in more detail. But if you look at that dotted line in the center there, you can see that the tremendous amount of the growth was really because of growth in facilities. There's a couple of reasons for that. There were facilities that were wearing out. There were new kinds of codes like the ADA and the fire marshal's inspection of school districts, and there were also the pupil unit growth that led to a lot of new school construction during the 80s and 90s. The result of that is when you take that out, you get the dotted line. And then the next line, the bottom line on this chart says, and what about if you take out special education revenue, then you can, or expenses revenue? You can see that that revenue grew to slightly less than $8,000, about $7,500 per pupil. And then the next chart says, what about if you take those lines and adjust for funding, or for inflation, rather? And these are the same three lines you just saw. The top one is adjusted for inflation. School district funding went from about $4,000 to about $6,000. Factor out the buildings, that is, take that dotted line and look at that, and you can see the growth rate was much lower. And then if you take out the expenses that school districts have on special education, you can see that we started at a little under $4,000 on the line with the dots on it, and ended up just a little bit over $4,000 over a 20-year period. So what these charts are designed to do is not to tell you a particular story, but rather to give you some perspective on why people think very different things have happened in school funding over the last 20 years. And I think this can help set some context for you about why when legislators, particularly those not on the K-12 committee, tend to see that first line on the first chart, and school board members tend to see the last line on this chart. And all of these are fair representations. They're not tricks, but they're designed to show you different ways of thinking about what's happened to school funding over time.
Representative Greiland.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. John and Mr. Curl. These are very helpful charts because sometimes I think even those of us on this committee need reminding about this. You know, I know that I do because I hear from my school districts that, adjusted for inflation, their funding has been flat or they're 10% lower than they thought they were before adjusted for inflation. So I think this is the most valuable thing we've done here so far today, to keep all of us reminded that that we haven't done very well by our schools, never mind what the numbers show. My question is, do these numbers include the local levies, or is it just state funding?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, these three sets of graphs are based on what we call total revenue. They include federal funds, they include fees, they include state aid, and they include local levies. So they're the big ball of wax to all the money that school districts are spending.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, that some of my districts say if we just count the, if we don't count what they did themselves, that we are like 10% below where we were 10 years ago and things like that. Are you going to have charts like that that break it out, taking away the local effort?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, when we get into that, it gets to be a real mess because of the property tax shifts, because of the takeover of the levy and things like that. You would see because of the takeover of the school levy that your school district's levy is less now than it was 10 years ago. So or at least on average, I shouldn't single out your school district. So really the bottom line here on this chart is what the average school district is facing. They're paying less property tax now than they were 10 years ago. Their revenue is more on an inflation-adjusted basis than it was 10 years ago, and their revenues sorted out for things like the buildings and special ed is still slightly more than it was 10 years ago. So for the average school district in the state, they're still going to be seeing more. Now, the district may say, well, we have other factors. We have health insurance costs that have gone through the roof, or we have transportation costs that have gone way up. But if you measure on this chart from 94 to 2003, you're going to see for a 10-year period, and again, that's an arbitrary, you know, you can choose any years you want, but if you chose that arbitrary 10-year period, you'd see that there still, on average, has been some real increase in the level of per pupil support. So it's really hard, and when we separate out just the local levy because of the big changes in 2003, fiscal 2003, you'll see some surprising effects. So I don't This may be a too long-winded answer, but I don't think that's really going to be the case for the average district. It could be for an individual district, particularly one where they've added a building, a substantial building debt since in the last 10 years. They could be having a higher degree of levy now than they did 10 years ago, but for most districts, their property tax now is lower than it was 10 years ago.
Madam Chair and members, the next pie chart, titled District Operating Expenditures per Student, is based on the school district profile data. So the most recent expenditure data we have is from fiscal 2002-2003. From last January, we should be getting an update on this. But this is still useful for you to look at, to kind of look at what districts end up spending their money on. You can see that instructional services, including regular instruction, vocational instruction, if you include special education and instructional support and pupil support services, you're talking about around 70% of the district's, 70 to 75% of the district's budget. Capital expenditures and operations and maintenance each count for about 5%, transportation for another 5%, district administration for another 5%, and support services district support services for about another 5%. We just thought it would be interesting and useful for you to kind of get a context of where districts are spending their money. And again, this coming from the expenditure data, and if we use school district profiles expenditure data, for the most part, when you see that, that's going to be all things considered, federal, state, local, and fee revenue. And finally, the last table, called school district characteristics, gets at what we talked about before, that districts are very...
We have another question from Representative Heidfeld.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Back to that same page again. Vocational instruction. Are you? What's included in there?
Madam Chair, Representative Heidfeld, and that's any vocational, the shop or the auto mechanics or the Ag, any programs, okay. Anything we consider when we're talking about the career and technical revenue generally, is vocational instruction.
Okay.
So then on the characteristics, Madam Chair and members, this is really just to highlight for you how difficult your job is. People say that the school funding formulas are complex and hard to understand. One of the problems is that there isn't an average school district in Minnesota. And when you design funding formulas, it's difficult to design a funding formula for an average school district because they are so different. We talked a bit about pupil size, about enrollment, not about pupil size, because we don't care how short or tall they are. But and so that's on this page as well, but I also want to point out there's a broad variation in operating expenditures per student. If you look at the first table at the top of that page, the lowest district is about $4,700 a pupil. That's not really representative. That's why we always talk about the 5th and 95th percentile. That's actually a cooperating district, so there's some weird things happening with those numbers. And same thing goes with the highest spending district, $22,000. But if you look at the 5th and 95th percentile, there's a $4,000 range in how much districts are spending per student. And the median is about $8,000, and it goes from about $6,600 to about $11,000 of expenditures per pupil. Districts are different in terms of their tax capacity. If you look at adjusted net tax capacity per pupil unit, I don't have the lowest and highest on here, but the lowest would be zero, no tax capacity per pupil, or a couple dollars. There's a couple school districts that are down in the under $10 per pupil unit range, and I think our highest is above 20. It's above $20,000 per pupil in tax capacity. So, and even the range from the 5th to the 95th percentile, when you consider that, is almost $7,000, from 2416 to
to $9,000 per pupil in tax capacity. And again, on the bottom, if you're looking at enrollment, 33% of the districts only have 5% of the enrollment in the state. So the smallest, and if you go to the cumulative, 66% of the districts, and this gets to the chart Tim had, or even the smallest 88% of the districts. If you take all the districts under 4,500 enrollment, that's only 23% of all the kids. The vast majority of the kids in the state are in the 40 largest districts. 60% of the kids are enrolled. I'm sorry, 42% are in the under 4,500. 60% of the kids are in districts with enrollment greater than 4,500 students. So as you're thinking about how a school funding system should be designed, it's difficult to say this will do X or Y for the average school district, because there isn't an average school district in terms of size, in terms of tax capacity, in terms of current expenditures. And there are a lot of different ways we look at school districts, and very few of those ways are all 343 districts like each other. I noticed when Tim mentioned Section 8, someone glanced with kind of fear in their eyes at the clock. We're finished with Section 3. We won't keep you here until we get to Section 8, and maybe... And so maybe this is a good time to break. We have one more. Tim did some fancy editing on this one, but it got the numbers in response to Representative Bernardi.
Yeah. But the last chart you just looked at was a different way of breaking down students by size of district. Back to our chart where Representative Bernardi's question came up, and we can print this out separate so this looks nice for you. But essentially, if you divide the state into those five groups of school districts with 69 mm-hmm. school districts in each group, the lowest group was 69. We've got 69 school districts in the state with between 0 and 425 kids. And that's grades K to 12. We've got 69 districts with less than 426 kids. The next group only goes from 425 to 735 kids. So now 40% of the school districts in the state, less than 735 kids. The middle fifth group of districts in the state go from 736 to 1,229 kids. And then the 40% of the largest districts in the state, the fourth quintile, go from 1,200 to 2,561. So even when you get through that, 80% of the school districts are only up to an enrollment of 2,561 kids. And then in that last cluster of school districts, the largest 68 districts in the state, they range from $2,561 or 61 pupils to $41,291 on a pupil unit basis. So it gives you some sense of the very uneven distribution of students among school districts in the state.
Now, are there any last questions on the presentation so far? Otherwise, we'll pick this up where we left off. We'll pick it up tomorrow, going on to state aids to schools. Yes, please keep it in the order so that you will have it, and just keep it in the file that you got today, and we'll move on with it tomorrow. And thank you very much for your attention and your good questions. We need to thoroughly understand this if we're going to make good policies. So. I think we'll adjourn the meeting on this note.